Well, thank you, Fritz, and wonderful to be with you all. It's been about 6 months, I believe, since I was here doing a multi-part series on a book I wrote last year on Francis Schaeffer. And so it's always a great blessing to be with you all and so many friends here. I just noticed Mac Kaiser coming in. Mac, good to see you as well. And so very much looking forward to this topic. As Fritz indicated, I was, and my wife was very involved in the Jesus Movement back in the early 70s. We were out at Calvary Chapel, which was kind of the epicenter of the Jesus Movement at the height of it all. And so it had quite a profound impact on my life, which I'll be sharing, I think, at our third session together. But we'll start in just a minute with the movie Jesus Revolution. And I just wanted to ask, how many of you have seen that film that came out? The majority have seen that film. And how many were involved to some extent or another in the Jesus Movement personally back in the 70s? Okay, a few. So certainly I would welcome your input and comments as we go along through the study as well. There's another movie other than Jesus Revolution that I would highly recommend. Many of you, I think, have probably already seen it, and it's called The Sound of Freedom. It's about sex trafficking. Again, if you don't mind, how many have seen that? So looks like nearly half. So highly recommend it. I think it just debuted about a week and a half ago or so. So it's a very disturbing movie, which every Christian should see, and everyone who cares about the state of our nation and the terrible sex trafficking that's going on worldwide. We always hear that Atlanta, by the way, is one of the hubs for this sex trafficking, and I know Perimeter Church has been very involved in that for many years now, to its great credit. Well, I wanted to mention that I have written a short history of the Jesus Movement. We have copies back there on the table. It's called The Jesus Movement Revisited. And as I said, it's not a comprehensive history, a short history, but I think it touches most of the key points. And I also include in the book lyrics for several, well, actually, I think it's about 20 or 30 of the most representative songs from the period. As many of you know, the Jesus Movement produced an enormous amount of quality, very creative music. And that was one of the earmarks of the movement. So again, if you're interested in reading more about it, I think we have copies back there on the table. Well, again, for those of you who have seen the film Jesus Revolution, and for those of you who have not seen it yet, it focuses on three individuals. One is Pastor Chuck Smith, who was the pastor of Calvary Chapel in Costa Mesa, California. And that role is played by Kelsey Grammer. Another key individual in the movie is a hippie evangelist by the name of Lonnie Frisbee, and he is played by Jonathan Rumi. Jonathan Rumi is the one who portrays Jesus in the series The Chosen, which probably a lot of you are familiar with as well. And then a third individual who's featured prominently in the film is Greg Laurie. And Greg Laurie later became the founder of Harvest Christian Fellowship out in California. It's one of the largest churches in California, and he was very much influenced by the early aspects of the Jesus Movement as well. And so let's start, if we can, with just a short 3 or 4 minute video clip on the film for those of you who've not seen it, and also just a reminder for those who have.
Hey, Square.
I am not a square.
I think we should invite Greg this weekend.
What's this weekend?
The mountain is high.
How are we doing, Southern California?
These people are hippies, rebels against old-fashioned authority.
I think these kids need help.
they need is a bath.
You're passing judgment on people you know nothing about.
Maybe that's why your church is so empty.
When God walks in here, brings me a hippie, I'll ask him what it's all about, because I do not understand.
This house has a very good vibe. There is an entire generation searching.
Slow down, man, slow down.
Just in all the wrong places. If you want to reach my people, you need to speak to them in a language they understand.
If I bring them in, I'm going to lose my job.
We can only walk through doors open to us. In your church, that's a door that's shut.
You've probably noticed we have some guests here today. I'd like you to meet my new friends. Welcome.
They don't belong here. Half of them aren't even wearing shoes.
They're staining the new shag carpet.
They need our help. If you feel like you're misunderstood and judged, you will find forgiveness and freedom right here.
That was awesome.
Now that door is open any time of day. And if there are some who don't like that, well then that door works both ways.
All right, Pastor, let's begin.
I was almost done with this, but then you did what nobody else would even dare.
This thing that we found, I feel like I belong.
You're gonna need a bigger church.
Our country is a dark and divided place, but now there's hope and it's spreading.
This is your home, and I want you to tell all your friends about it.
Fritz and Gary are our technology angels. For this morning. Okay, thank you very much. For those of us who are techno-challenged. Okay, so thank you very much. All right. Well, as I said, my presentations will be based on the booklet I wrote back there. And there is so much in Christian history, as many of you know, that's very, very inspiring and that we can learn from. Unfortunately, though, most Christians, I've noticed over the years, tend to be as presentistic-minded as most everybody else. Most have relatively little interest in what preceded us. And this lack of appreciation of our history, I think, is a reason why so much of contemporary evangelicalism is so very, very shallow. Now, the Jesus movement of the late 1960s and 70s was truly a spiritual phenomenon. There's really not been anything like it. There was no charismatic founder or central organizing institution necessarily. Truly, it was a spirit-led movement. It sprang up organically and spread all across America and actually into Great Britain and other countries as well. It was a spirit-inspired response to the unique social and cultural milieu of the 1960s, the late 1960s. And in that respect, it included popular music and art, including popular music and art of the counterculture at the time. And used these art forms to communicate the timeless truths of the Christian faith. Now, it was also a response to at least the perceived, what was oftentimes perceived as the staleness of conventional status quo church life in America back in the 60s as well. Now, in my book, I talk about, we start, of course, with the trailer. I talk about the 1960s as being a decade of destiny. At least that's how it was hyped at the very outset. In fact, it very quickly degenerated, as you all know, into a decade of decadence. I talk about the origins of the Jesus movement, the epicenter, which was Calvary Chapel, again, Pastor Chuck Smith, others like Lonnie Frisbee, and so on. It became, within a couple of years, an absolute nationwide phenomenon. Expo 72, which some of you might recall, or perhaps some of you were even there at the time. It also led to a proliferation of Jesus movement communities and coffee houses around the country, and several publications, notable publications, came out of the Jesus movement as well. The house church movement was somewhat inspired by the Jesus movement, as were a lot of pseudo-Christian cults that sort of hung out on the periphery and picked off, people from time to time. Probably the most notorious of all these pseudo-Christian cults would have been the Children of God, which, again, some of you may remember. We talk about Jesus music. We'll do that next week, primarily in the following week. And also an assessment of the movement, its strengths and its weaknesses, and then a postscript, if time allows, some personal reflections as well. So I want to start with this verse from 2 Peter, well-known verse, 2 Peter 3:9. God is not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. And I think that verse, as well as any, kind of encapsulates the spirit of the Jesus movement. So we saw the trailer for the movie, and we'll look at the origins, the impact, the legacy of what I think is probably the most unique revival, or at least spiritual awakening, in all of American Christian history. Now, I'd like to start, though, with at the outset of the 1960s, again, as I say here, this was considered to be a new decade of great optimism and potential and so on. In fact, the Youth for Christ theme in 1960 at their 16th annual gathering was Decade of Destiny. And I wanted to play the theme song that Thurlow Spurr came up with for the Youth for Christ campaign there beginning in 1960. So if we could go ahead and cue that up and play Decade of Destiny. Okay, well, the first thing that comes to mind listening to that song, if we had time, we could talk about it in more depth. But stylistically, very much out of sync with the 60s, isn't it? Say the least. And yet it does convey this great sense of evangelical optimism at the turn of the 1960s. But very quickly, this decade of destiny has to deal with real-world realities. And generally, evangelicalism was out of touch with the realities of American cultural trends. Evangelical Christianity was focused more on, in fact, almost exclusively on evangelism and personal piety, or pietism, as Francis Schaeffer wrote about. We talked about that a few months ago. It's a decade that actually would be characterized by a lot of social and political chaos. We have, for instance, the civil rights movement really gathering steam during that time. We have political assassinations and assassinations of other national leaders. The Vietnam War is raging. There's urban riots beginning in 1968. We have the emergence of the counterculture, typically characterized by sex and drugs and rock and roll. Now, evangelical culture, as portrayed in that previous song, and in general throughout America, was satirized by Joseph Bailey in his novel and what became a subsequent film called The Gospel Blimp. Dare I ask, how many of you have ever seen The Gospel Blimp? Okay, that's good. That's 3%. Okay, that's pretty good. Okay. Very, very quickly, what was this book and movie about? Well, George and Ethel, I don't remember their last names, but George and Ethel are concerned about the salvation of their next-door neighbors, but they don't know how to reach them with the gospel. So during an evening barbecue with some Christian friends, somebody comes up with the brilliant idea of buying a blimp, hiring a pilot, and flying over the town and dumping huge amounts of gospel tracts on the town. I would call this a high-tech, you know, solution to the problem. That struck everyone as very, very effective or potentially effective. And they also thought, well, yes, that'll get people's attention. Certainly did, but not necessarily for the right reasons. So besides filling the town with litter, the campaign turns into a total fiasco. George finally comes to realize that sharing the gospel through personal interactions with neighbors and other people is considerably more effective. And so this movie, Gospel Blimp, it was filmed on a very small budget, and it has the look and sound of a home movie. Actually, you can download it on YouTube now if you'd like to see it. It's not very long, I think 45 minutes or so. But it really characterizes, unfortunately, some of the dominant mentality in evangelical Christianity in the early and mid-1960s. Now, very quickly, this decade of destiny turns into a decade of outright decadence. And I think there's no more representative song of the time than Bob Dylan's The Times They Are A-Changin'. It's a good reminder to go back periodically and listen to that song again. It really captures what's going to be taking place over the next several years, and actually next several decades. Now, 30 years after writing The Times They Are Changin', Dylan released another album, and one of the songs I noticed on that album in 1993 was a song called Everything Is Broken. The times they are changin', and by the way, everything is broken. It's a great commentary when you put those two songs together on the direction of Western civilization in general and American civilization in particular. So this is, since the 60s, as all of you know, this has been a time of social and sexual and moral and political breakdown. And what it has led to is the dissolution of most of the values and principles on which our nation and, frankly, Western civilization were based. Now, today, we're far removed from a decade of decadence. Since then, we've been wallowing more in a decade of depravity. That characterizes more effectively the state of modern America. We are in a state not of decadence so much as outright depravity. Never before in Western history has outright depravity been not only tolerated, but absolutely celebrated and promoted in every area of our culture, from government and business to education, to journalism, to popular culture, and of course, popular entertainment as well. We're living in a time in which basic standards of decency and civility are absolutely disintegrating. I'm sure you've noticed. Including even the very rule of law itself. Now, Christians and Christian leaders had better step up and start demonstrating some courage in confronting the great evils that we're facing today and stop hiding behind the pathetic excuse, quote, oh, we don't mix politics and Christianity, or we don't mix controversial social issues with Christianity. Because I think, as all of us understand, in reality, the most consequential so-called political issues and social issues of our time are actually spiritual issues, and they are moral issues. So saying that we don't talk about such things in church is tantamount to saying there are certain moral principles that most of which mankind has believed in for thousands of years. We're just going to fail to address those sorts of things. And frankly, to fail to address these kind of issues head on is not only irresponsible, it's absolutely cowardly. And I would recommend very, very highly to you Eric Metaxas's new book, A Letter to the American Church. I think it does as well as any recent publication to highlight the lack of courage that we see in contemporary evangelical Christianity. Well, in 1966, many of you remember this Time magazine cover story, Is God Dead? And there was a famous, somewhat famous professor at Emory Candler School of Theology named Altizer, who was promoting the God is dead. He was kind of resurrecting some of the same themes and arguments that Friedrich Nietzsche had used in the late 1800s and so on. But for many, this was the inevitable trend, the death of God. Now, by the way, those that were promoting this concept never believed that there ever was a God in the first place. What they're arguing is that what we're seeing is the death of belief in God. But in their minds, it's just a fantasy anyway. Okay, so that seems to be the inevitable trend. At that time, again, you see there in 1966. And so something like the Jesus movement was just an absolute phenomenon. And it reversed so much of that trend. And thank God that that was the case. Now, the Jesus movement primarily appealed to young people. People in their late teens and 20s and so on, but there were many others that were involved in it as well. And it also appealed primarily to those that associated with the counterculture, basically dropouts. And those of you who've studied this period, you know that when we're talking about the counterculture, there's basically two kind of murky, ill-defined components to the counterculture. One was the New Left coalition, neo-Marxists, socialists, and so on. And this would be characterized by the SDS, the Berkeley Free Speech Movement, which very quickly turned into the Berkeley Obscene Speech Movement, by the way. The anti-nuke movement, anti-war movement, black militancy, black power, gay rights movement, and radical feminism. So that certainly was part of what we usually associate with the counterculture. But primarily, it wasn't this kind of politicized orientation. The counterculture, generally, we think of hippies. And these would be people who, for various reasons, some not all bad, by the way, but for various reasons, were social rebels and dropouts. Many were products of secular homes, godless homes, basically, products of broken homes, products of privileged elite families. That was certainly the case. Products of drug and alcohol abuse, and products of the sexual revolution. They were also products of pop culture. And here's a collage I put together, a montage, rather, that I put together, which I think captures some of the major themes. Many of you remember this quite well, pop culture in the 1960s. Now, also, many in the counterculture are products of pop philosophy. Bits of wisdom, quote, such as, do your own thing. If it feels good, do it. That's good advice, isn't it? turn on, tune in, and drop out. Now, that was popularized by the high priest of LSD back in those days, Timothy Leary. And don't trust anyone over 30, which I remember at the time thinking, wait a minute, Jesus was over 30. anyway, you get the point there. So products of pop philosophy. But there's more to it than that, at least in some cases. Some people who associate with counterculture had this back-to-nature orientation. Some were communitarians. In other words, they wanted to live in communities. I'm sorry, they weren't Christian yet. But basically those who believed in community living and sharing resources and so on. Some were social critics, and partly rightly so in some respects. Some were avant-garde artists. Many claimed to be non-materialists, although usually they had rather extensive record collections. But other than that, non-materialists. And there were also introspectionists. This is to be taken seriously. Probably the most representative album in the 1960s in terms of serious introspection would be Johnny Rivers' album, Realization. Some of you may remember it, but even today it's good to go back and revisit that. So the point here is that the counterculture movement is quite a coalition. They're obviously not all alike. Okay. Now, also, some are spiritual seekers. Some are serious spiritual seekers, and that's basically what's highlighted in the movie Jesus Revolution. People who are looking for love, who are looking for peace, and are looking for God, but in all the wrong places. Okay. Now, essential reading on the 1960s, and when I was getting my doctorate degree in history, one of my areas of focus was on the 1960s. I wanted to try and make sense of the 60s, and even though I got a doctorate, I still don't quite know, quite have the ability to make sense of the 60s. It was very, very complex, but good insight into the period would be, for instance, these books. Most of them are written by secular, including some who are pro-socialist, pro-Marxist historians. The last one, of course, The Dust of Death, that's written by Os Guinness. Many of you are familiar with Os Guinness, a great Christian thinker today. And so, again, they really encapsulate, I think, this decade of decadence in which we have the civil rights movement going on. Now, the civil rights movement is a very legitimate movement, but the civil rights marches and demonstrations, see, what they do is unleash a torrent of pent-up frustrations, and in this case, it was perfectly justified. But anyway, what it did was result in a new legislation that eliminated all systemic or institutionalized or legalized forms of racial discrimination. And, of course, we all celebrate that today. In addition, though, the civil rights movement also sparked a lot of the subsequent social protest of the decade that was not legitimate. We have the anti-war protests over the war in Vietnam. Politically, we have the rise of the New Left, the beginning of the infiltration of American cultural institutions by neo-Marxists, and those are influenced by godless secular Marxism, secular socialism, infiltrating academia, the media, and every other area of life. Actually, today, corporate America is probably as infused with those values as any other aspect of American society and culture. And then socially, of course, we have the sexual revolution. We have the women's liberation movement. We have the emergence of abortion, quote, rights. We have the gay rights movements. We have the emergence of the hippie counterculture, sex and drugs and rock and roll and so on. Now, one book that I would consider essential reading for understanding the spirit of the times in America during that time, it's a book that's oftentimes kind of overlooked, but I think it's very important, is this. It's The Greening of America by Charles Reich. And you see there what Reich writes in his introduction. He tells us, and by the way, he's fully in favor of these trends. He says there's a revolution coming. It will not be like revolutions of the past. It will originate with the individual and with culture, and it will change the political structure only as its final act. Well, we certainly see that happening. It will not require violence to succeed, and it cannot be successfully resisted by violence. This is the revolution, he says, of the new generation. So in that respect, he's a bit of a secular prophet, unfortunately, when it comes to the emerging, you know, trends that will predominate in America. Well, let's transition now to the Jesus movement per se. And there's a couple of books that I'd highly recommend. One is co-written by Greg Laurie and Ellen Vaughn, and it's called Jesus Revolution. It's a pretty easy, breezy read, and it's the book on which the movie is based. A second book, though, which goes into considerably more detail on the Jesus movement, is a book called God's Forever Family. And so, again, if this is an area of interest to you, I'd highly recommend reading both of these books. And then again, my kind of overview of the Jesus Revolution as well. All right, so let's take a look here at the beginnings of this movement. And it starts in 1967 in, of all places, San Francisco. Okay, so why would it start in San Francisco in 1967? Well, 1967 was so-called Summer of Love, and San Francisco was the epicenter of the counterculture, both the hippie, hedonistic counterculture, but also the new left, militant Marxist counterculture as well. So in 1967, there's four couples, including Ted and Liz Wise, who you see here on the screen, and some others, who open the Living Room in downtown San Francisco. And what the Living Room was a storefront coffee house and a mission. They were trying to reach out to hippies and others of the youth culture there in downtown San Francisco in the Haight-Ashbury district, of course. And they also, though, formed, in addition to the Living Room outreach ministry, they also formed a Christian community called the House of Acts. And shortly thereafter, they were joined by another couple, a very young couple, Lonnie Frisbee and his wife, Kathy Frisbee. Now, about the same time that that was going on, over in Berkeley, across the bay in Berkeley, we had Jack Sparks, who was, by the way, a former professor and Campus Crusade staffer at the University of California, Berkeley. And he helps found what's called the Christian World Liberation Front. He founds it officially in 1969. And it's designed to be an outreach ministry to students. And it has a more politicized orientation, even though it is a Christian, you know, movement. But it's a little more politicized than, for instance, what was going on in San Francisco in Haight-Ashbury. The group later changed its name to the Berkeley Christian Coalition, by the way. And the organization published a magazine called Right On, picking up on a familiar theme of the 60s. They later renamed it Radix. And, of course, Radix, that's the root word, the Latin root word for radical, isn't it? But it actually means the true meaning of the word radical is the root part of a system. In other words, radix, that's the root of, you know, a bush, a tree, you know, any kind of plant. And so by calling their magazine Radix, they wanted to deal with essential, fundamental, basic Christianity. And yet Right On and Radix were not so much evangelistic Jesus movement type of newspapers as they were a social commentary on the great social and cultural issues of the time. In the early 1970s, the Berkeley Christian Coalition also founded a publication called SCP Journal. Some of you may be familiar with it. That's the Spiritual Counterfeits Project, because, among other things, the hippie movement was being infiltrated by a lot of people that later we would call New Agers. And so the Berkeley Christian Coalition thought that that was something in particular they needed to focus on, was this revival of ancient Gnosticism, which we call, again, the New Age movement. And they wanted to expose the New Age pseudo-spirituality and the various cults that were preying on people who were associated with the counterculture in the San Francisco and Berkeley areas at the time. By the way, Jack Sparks later became, along with some other campus crusade leaders like John Braun and Peter Gilquist and others, some of those names may be familiar to you, they founded the Evangelical Orthodox Church in the early 1970s. Now, meanwhile, in Southern California, in Los Angeles and Hollywood in particular, we have Duane Peterson emerging with his publication called The Hollywood Free Paper. And this happened initially in 1968. Peterson founds a Christian newspaper, The Hollywood Free Paper, as an alternative to all the popular countercultural and left-wing underground newspapers. Underground, so-called underground, as they were known back in those days. Here in Atlanta, we had an underground newspaper that functioned for, gosh, at least 10 or 15 years, called The Great Speckled Bird. And if you're a longtime Atlanta resident, you may recall The Great Speckled Bird. Now, Peterson also became an early chronicler of the Jesus movement, and his book, The Jesus People, which he wrote in 1971, introduced a lot of mainstream evangelicals to what was going on in this movement. So you see some of the titles of some of the publications there, some of the issues, Jesus Loves You, and so on, and Occult and Mysticism or Jesus. Again, the New Age being a major rival, a pseudo-spiritual rival back in those days. But probably his best-known cover story was this one. And I can only imagine how impressed Jesus was. And so, anyway, Jesus is better than hash. Yeah, obviously. Okay. All right, now, other things are going on in Los Angeles and Hollywood in particular at the time as well. We have Arthur Blessett emerging and preaching on the streets of Hollywood. He was a very gifted natural evangelist. In 1968, he started a ministry based on a local coffee house that he called His Place. And it was an alternative nightclub on Sunset Strip. In fact, it was located right next door to a topless go-go club. And he soon acquired the title as the minister of Sunset Strip. He really was kind of the quintessential hip minister of the day. He urged young people to turn on to Jesus and referred to salvation as an eternal rush. Again, I'm not sure we need, you know, analogies like that, but nonetheless. In 1969, local businesses lobbied to shut down his establishment, His Place. And so Blessett responded by chaining himself to a 12-foot cross in front of the building, and he fasted for 28 days. The impasse finally was broken when Blessett was provided space in another building just a few blocks away, and he could continue his ministry. Then beginning on Christmas Day in 1969, he literally began a cross-country trek from Los Angeles to Washington, D.C., carrying a huge wooden cross and witnessing along the way to everyone whom he encountered. During that time, he said he heard the voice of Jesus calling him to take the cross to every nation, which eventually he actually did. He actually got into the Soviet Union and China and every place else in the world, according to his claims. And for the next 30 years, actually, continued to witness for Christ, reportedly, in the early 1980s. He was an influential voice in leading George W. Bush to faith in Jesus Christ as well. So Arthur Blessed. Now, I'd like to transition into a song that kind of represents the spirit of the time in a personalized sense. As we know, there were an increasing number of people who had been involved in the counterculture that were being drawn to Jesus, who had been searching for God in all the wrong places, and were coming to faith in Jesus Christ. Now, among those was a singer-songwriter by the name of John Michael Talbot. And his song, Hallelujah, really describes his spiritual search through New Age mysticism, through Eastern religions, until he finds hope and truth when, quote, the Son of God, the Son of Man, beckoned him, and the Spirit of the Light came in true love. When we play the song, can we also show the lyrics on the screen? Oh, they cancel each other out? Okay, in that case, let me show the lyrics and then we can play the song. Yeah, okay. So I gazed into the stars, I followed where the eastern light to show. I tried to find the light to fill my aching soul. He was a somewhat successful singer-songwriter, recording artist at the time, but this emptiness, this spiritual void, could not be filled by fame and success in the music business. I looked into the ocean. I walked upon the mountaintops. He's searching for God in nature, you know. I trusted in my guardian, tried to set my spirit free. Kind of sounds New Agey. And then the Son of Man, he beckoned me. The Spirit of the Light came in true love. And like a gentle summer breeze, so comforting and so free, he gave the light of freedom within me. He is the morning star. He causes all the lights to shine and walks within the garden beside me. He lives within me. And from the depths of the seas, beyond the highest mountaintops, he causes all the universe to be. And I sing hallelujah, sing praise to my Lord. Sing hallelujah, hallelujah, sing praises to my Lord. So those are the lyrics. But let's listen to this beautiful song composed by John Michael Talbot.
Stars, I followed where the eastern light does show. I've tried to find the light to fill my aching soul. I've looked into the oceans, I've walked upon the mountaintop, I've trusted in my guardian. Son of Man, he beckoned me. The Spirit of
Yeah, thank you. Beautiful song. And again, if you have the lyrics there in front of you, it's all the more meaningful. Now, let's see. Fritz, I'm not sure when we are supposed to end. I know it's sometime before 11:30 p.m. tonight. Pardon me? Oh, 10:15. Oh, so we actually do have some time for interaction and all. Comments, any relevant comments and or questions? In fact, I think we have time for me to tell you a little bit more about John Michael Talbot. And then I'll just kind of open it up for comments, questions on your part. And then we'll next week, we'll begin looking at sort of the epicenter of the Jesus movement, which was Calvary Chapel in Costa Mesa, California, near Santa Ana in Orange County, California. Well, in 1969, John Michael Talbot, along with his brother Terry, formed a country rock band called Mason Prophet. And they were one of the first country rock bands at the time. And they achieved a measure of success, but John Michael Talbot in particular felt, as I mentioned earlier, very spiritually empty nonetheless. So he explored all the hip trends of the day. He looked into Eastern mysticism, into nature worship, into transcendental meditation, Zen Buddhism. He even checked out Native American spirituality and so on. But in his spiritual quest, he prayed regularly to, quote, whatever God there might be, to reveal himself to him. And one night in 1971, as he lay on his bed in a Holiday Inn hotel room, he prayed aloud, Lord, just who are you anyway? And he writes this, quote, in his biography, light seemed to fill the room, intensifying by degrees. Startled, I sat up, blinking my eyes, assessing the situation there before me. In mind-bending brilliance was a figure of a man in white robes, arms outstretched with long hair and a beard. He didn't say anything. He was just there, and I felt in him a sense of awesome power, overwhelming strength, yet the capacity to be very, very gentle as well. I felt he could judge me in my smallness and my sinfulness, but I perceived his forgiveness instead. He stood before me, somehow almost around me, in infinite greatness, yet total humility. I felt compassion, I felt acceptance, and I knew that it was Jesus. The experience had a transforming effect on Talbot. He writes, I experienced a changed life. I felt deep love for others, forgiveness and tenderness, new levels of compassion, as if I had somehow absorbed these qualities from the Christ figure in the vision. A year or so later, his brother also came to faith in Christ. Their conversions, of course, caused some problems within their band, and so they disbanded Mason Prophet, and they recorded a Christian album called The Talbot Brothers Reborn, and they both went on to perform as solo Christian artists throughout the 1970s. And actually, by the late 1970s, John Michael Talbot converted to the Catholic faith, and he started a monastery in the Ozark Mountains of northwest Arkansas. And you can go there and visit today. It's a very pleasant retreat center. With that, why don't we just kind of open things up for a few minutes, and any comments, questions you might have, or in lieu of that, we can always move forward into the topic for next week as well. Yes, please. Oh, and I know we have microphones, which usually work. Yeah,
I think I have one, and after I ask my question and have a quick advertisement, when you give me a microphone, I'm almost as dangerous as Jerry Tim's sitting over there, but not quite, so you can rest. Then I'll walk around this side if anybody else has any questions. So, and Dwight, of course, wants to be number first. So anyway, the quick advertisement, well, actually it's a prayer request, is Bill Wood, Jeff Norris, and myself head for Poland tonight. We will be with our ministry partners in Krakow, in Warsaw, in Poznan, where Andrew Gorski lives. But you know all the normal prayer requests, but the one specific one that I would have is Tuesday, Jeff, Bill, and I will be in Auschwitz-Birkenau. For those of you that have been there, it is one of the most impactful things that you'll ever go through. And if anybody has any doubts on the total depravity of mankind, Auschwitz will put that to bed once and for all. So that's my prayer request. My comment, and this may be just incredibly obvious, or I'm sitting here in left field, but as you're going through the history of the 60s, which most of us in this room, maybe not Charles, but most of us have lived through, I'm looking at that and I'm saying this is like deja vu. I mean, some of the things have changed a little bit, but we have a Jesus movement in a different format with the rise of community churches, non-denominational churches. There's a lot of movements that we see, a lot of free churches and stuff like that. And it seems like we have the same challenges. They take a little bit different meaning, but some are same. And now a lot are the greater emphasis on climate change and ESG and everything else that's going on in our business world. Jeff, is that kind of what's going on? Is this something that you dwell on? Is this the same or same with differences?
Yes, I teach a lot on that and have written a lot on that as well, especially in a book I wrote and just updated, by the way, I think it's back there, American Crisis. And American Crisis, it deals with the origins, the philosophy, the historical origins, the philosophy, the agenda of cultural Marxism or political correctness, and how it's just absolutely wreaking havoc on our society and culture. So the difference, though, would be that back in these days, the radical left and radical anti-Christian forces were still pretty much marginalized and on the periphery of mainstream society. Now, 50 years later, they are the establishment. And it's up to us as Christians to realize that these people are literally hell-bent on controlling every aspect of our lives and every aspect of American society and culture. And they are succeeding brilliantly because they meet with so little opposition, frankly. So they're the establishment now. I mean, look at academia, the legal profession, education, obviously the entertainment industry. And unfortunately, those kind of secular ideas now are infiltrating a lot of churches, including evangelical churches. So we need to be very vigilant about that. This is a very evil agenda, and we need to be well-informed and well-engaged. And there are people in this room who are extremely engaged in this issue. And I have the highest respect for those of you who are. So thank you. Yeah, good observation. Thank you.
Okay. All right. I have heard stories about Bob Dylan became a Christian and then maybe later had second thoughts and maybe didn't really mean it or some such thing. Can you share anything you know about that?
Yeah, I've written a lot on him. And in 1979, he got involved in a Vineyard Church in Hollywood and started going to a Bible study. He was baptized. In fact, if Judy Reamer were here, and why is she not? Is this an excused absence or what? Judy, if I remember correctly, Bob Dylan might have been baptized in by Pat Boone in Pat Boone's swimming pool. And of course, Judy knows Pat Boone quite well. So Dylan professed to be a Christian. He spent about 3 months in a Bible study at one of the Vineyard churches there in North Hollywood. Unfortunately, though, then he went right back out on the road and faced all the same temptations and all that he always had before. So he recorded three explicitly Christian albums, and they are remarkable. And if you've ever seen videos of some of his, quote, gospel concerts, it's very hard to think that he was anything other than just absolutely committed. But it only lasted about 3 years. And then for reasons that he's never been clear about, of course, he's always been extremely enigmatic, but for reasons that I don't think anybody really knows, he just kind of went back to making the same kind of music he had before. Not as blatantly immoral or anything. He never came out with another song like Everybody Must Get Stoned or anything like that. So it wasn't that. But in an interview maybe 15, 20 years ago, when asked about this, Dylan responded, well, I said everything I had to say in those three albums and in those concerts, and he just leaves it at that. So he's as enigmatic as he's ever been. Yeah. Thank you, though, for the question.
You're next, and then Jerry.
Yes.
Hi. It's always somewhat interesting to talk about movements that are my youth, because most movements I've studied are people who are already dead, and I don't think I'm dead yet. So
I observe similarly, yes.
One of the interesting things about my experience in that period of time is I was East Coast.
Okay.
And East Coast is different than West Coast.
Yeah.
In the West Coast, dollars are fun tickets. So the East Coast, they're investment vehicles. There's a definitely change in the worldview. And growing up in that time, we did not have definitive lines between the Jesus movement and the charismatic movement.
Okay.
It seems California was far better at branding than the East Coast was. We had other things that were more gratefully impacted, at least from my perspective, was, we had the censorship of Cassius Clay. We had a draft going on. We had people who were lying to us in the government about body counts. And those things, we were subject to the draft. We had the S-1 deferment go away. So suddenly, all these white kids who were available to go to school now mm-hmm. are subject to the draft. So mm-hmm. you enlisted in National Guards and other things like that. Mm-hmm. One of our presidents had done that as well. Mm-hmm. And so there is a great amount of cultural change that went on that had little to do with the Jesus movement, but I think the Jesus movement was just one of many responses, and that is, where are we going to get our truth from? Mm-hmm. Statism has failed us because we mm-hmm. used to rely on whatever the state told us was true. Well, that fell apart mm-hmm. because now we're fighting a war. We have the Great Society, all of which is failing, mm-hmm. And you didn't have to go far. In the Northeast, you had the Newark riots in 67.
Yeah.
And then you had Kent State murder
right.
as well. Those are the things yeah. that you had later. In the middle, mm-hmm. we had Woodstock,
yeah.
which was this grand rebellion, mm-hmm. which was quite secular. Mm-hmm. But the whole search was is that what we were being told is no longer true.
Mm-hmm.
Our churches were actually failing us as well. We had Reinhold Niebuhr describing our churches as a God without wrath, and a man without sin, and a Christ without cross.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was no more than just a community center at that point in
yes.
time. And so you couldn't believe your churches. The church that I grew up was run by an alcoholic, at least the youth group was. So that was one thing I wasn't going to go to.
Mm-hmm.
But you see the incipient socialization even getting into the churches. So I see the Jesus movement more as a rebellious movement to find what is truth.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have Francis Schaeffer coming mm-hmm. out of that too, is how shall we then live?
Yes.
In response to the 70s, what we saw in the Northeast was the rise of Bill Gothard, was this idea of Christian legalism and how you should respond to this. And it was very interesting to see that how that happened.
Yeah.
So there were different responses
yes.
to coming up with a worldview that weren't necessarily branded the Jesus movement, but
correct.
Shared many of those things. I yeah. listened to John Michael Talbot going to work on a four-track, of all things. So, I mean, it's kind of interesting to
well,
see
that,
this
that's
East
like
versus
18th
West.
Century, isn't it?
No, no. That's
no,
true.
I'm kidding.
My kids referred to 33 RPMs as black CDs, which I always thought was funny.
Well, you do have to define what a record is anymore, I've noticed, you know, when yeah. speaking to college students and so on.
So I'm not sure there's necessarily a question in there, yeah. but I do see yeah. the cultural impact okay. of what's being responded to
right.
is not just religious-based.
Yeah, well, you know, America has always been the most free and open nation in the world since the founding. And so, as we know, given mankind's sin nature, people are going to misuse that, you know, regularly. So we have had, to say the least, more than our fair share of religious diversity, and even within Christianity, and a lot of at least even borderline heretical movements masquerading as Christianity. Now, the Jesus movement, we'll talk about this more next week and the following week. It is not exclusively, but primarily an outgrowth of the charismatic movement. Yeah. Calvary Chapel, Chuck Smith was moderately charismatic. He, however, wrote about and spoke about charismania, as he called it, which he very much condemned. But and not all of those involved in the Jesus movement were self-identified charismatics, but many were. Yeah. Yep. So in the most free and open nation in world history, you can expect just incredible diversity, given, again, the realities of human nature. And that's what we've been blessed with and cursed with here in America since the very founding. Yeah, thank you.
I had two questions, but I yes. think that he Jay? Answered some of my first question.
Okay.
My first
well,
question
I'll
is that this one is called Jesus Revolution or Jesus Movement. Compared to what happened from early 1700 to 1900, we call it Great Awakening or Spiritual Revival. So should we understand this in the same context or different? I think that you answered some of the questions, so I would like to have your answer how we can differentiate those movements from 1900 and this one. And the other one is that in this historical context, how do you view what happened in Asbury earlier this year?
Okay, yeah, thank you, Jay. Well, we had two movements in American history prior to the 20th century that are generally referred to as Great Awakenings. One was in the 1730s and 40s, and that's George Whitefield, John Wesley, and many others as well. Gilbert Tennant, the Presbyterian evangelist, and so on. So that's the 1730s and 40s. Now, almost exactly 100 years later, actually more like about 90 years later, we have the Second Great Awakening. That's Charles Finney and several other notable American evangelists that you'd be familiar with. So that's the Second Great Awakening, the 1820s, 30s, 40s, and so on. So those are mainstream Protestant revivals. And you have Presbyterians and Baptists and Methodists and, you know, the major denominations, even Episcopalians back then, were somewhat involved in those Great Awakenings. By the turn of the 20th century, what you have is the influence of the Holiness Movement of the late 1800s and then the Pentecostal movement of the early that emerged in the early 1900s. And so American Christianity has become considerably more diverse, okay? And as I implied, the Jesus movement had a lot of charismatic influences in it. Not that everybody, you know, identified with that, but that was certainly a factor, and we'll talk more about it next week and the following. I'm sorry, the second part of your... Oh, Asbury. Well, I wouldn't, yeah, see, I think that maybe the proper term for what's happened at Asbury several months ago would be an awakening. Time will tell if it's a true revival or not, but it certainly was an awakening that impacted thousands of people. Again, primarily young adults, but certainly not exclusively. Likewise, the Jesus movement was primarily, but not exclusively, oriented toward young adults as well. Now, the Great Awakenings, the first and the second Great Awakenings, those were just very broad-based and multi-generational. But the Jesus movement was different in that respect, and the Asbury Awakening is different. Now, many of you know Elisa Childers or know of her, and I would recommend going back and listening to a podcast she did back in March or whenever the Asbury Awakening first emerged. And she has some wise counsel, I think, in that respect, especially in terms of the influences of what's called the NAR, the New Apostolic Reformation. If you're not familiar with it, please check it out, because it's a major movement today in America and worldwide, and there's extremely troubling aspects of it. So the NAR, New Apostolic Reformation. So she was just cautioning that hopefully the NAR would not be a major influence in what's going on at Asbury. So, thank you.
One last quickie.
Okay.
So I'll just try to keep this brief. A few months ago, I mentioned to everyone here about, you know, what's going on in Forsyth County with respect to the LGBTQ involvement with attempts to get drag events that would be open to minors to be able to attend. We were successful in getting that stopped. One of the ways in which we did that was we purchased up all the tickets.
Oh, okay.
But in addition to that, through the grapevine, the other side, if you will, began to discover, you know, what we were up to. And I think that what we all have to understand as I transition what some of my thoughts here is that I would say, based on how well I know many of us here in Harvesters, that we have either a somewhat to reasonably good understanding of what's going on in the world today and in the United States. But I'll propose a question to you to see. Does anyone in this room realize that the Department of Education has an Office of Civil Rights? The Department of Education has an Office of Civil Rights. So here's the reason why I bring this up. Jeff, to the point that you make, the other side is insidious. The degrees to which they have been so calculating and how they've gotten into every aspect of our society. And I can tell you that Dwayne Armstrong, myself, and Lars Lind have been very actively engaged with this in Forsyth County, which by many standards would be considered to be a conservative county. When you take a look at some of the books that are now showing up in the schools, Forsyth County now has a, although she no longer goes by this title, she is a director of diversity, equity, and inclusion. And it's her job to be involved in community relations. And just last night, I read a 14-page legal document from the letter. It's a letter from the Defense of Freedom Institute, which is a nonprofit, non-governmental organization, writing a 14-page legal document to the Office of Civil Rights. And here was the issue. Although we do not have it on complete authority, but we do have it on pretty good authority, that because of those of us who fought vigorously at the the Board of Education meeting to have certain books removed from the books of the schools, which ultimately the Board of Education voted 5-0 in favor of keeping the books on the shelves.
Really?
Mm-hmm. With restricted access. Slippery slope, okay? So one thing often leads to another with the way all this stuff goes. But because of the strong defense that was proposed and positioned before the Board of Education, presumably, and again upon what we consider to be good authority, one of the students went to this person who is this director of diversity education, and she goes by a different title now, which has changed twice. But through an open records request, we did get a copy of her current roles and responsibilities, which is exactly what it was when she got hired into this position. And by the way, her salary is $108,000 a year, which is, in many cases, more than twice the average what a public teacher gets paid in Forsyth County today. So take that into consideration. But we believe that what happened, and some of this came through the Federalist Society. So this is how far you have to dig through to get through all these root issues here. So having a superficial and somewhat reasonable understanding doesn't do us any real good. You have to get involved. You have to get involved in the details. We're dealing with constitutional authorities on some of these subject matters. It is a spiritual battle, as you indicated above. That is the root of the cultural issues. That's what's going on today. But it's very critical that we do become engaged. We can't just listen to what's happening on the news and shake our heads and say how bad this is. You have to sink your teeth into the issues. And that's where real fellowship also can begin to develop. Mm-hmm. And at this point, we have four other churches in Forsyth County that are engaged with us. And it's a battle. But we do happen to believe that on this issue that either a student was put up to doing it, but they filed what's called a harassment issue. And in the settlement, which I can give you a copy of, the director or the head of the Board of Education capitulated on the issues with the Office of Civil Rights with the Department of Education. So you can just imagine where this is headed in terms of the issues that we're going to have to deal with moving forward.
Okay.
That's one issue. So just think about how deep the tentacles have become in all of this.
Well, thank you, Jerry. And, you know, this is good and evil clashing. And too many Christians and Christian leaders want to be culture war pacifists. They won't even acknowledge that there is a culture war going on. Now, that's either out of abject ignorance or cowardice. But there is a ferocious culture war, and at the depths of it, as we know, it's a spiritual warfare going on. We don't need culture war pacifists, because that just concedes to the other side. So thank you for your comments. Very good being with you all, by the way. Looking forward to continuing next week. And another announcement did we have? Okay. So, all right. Time to close things down. All right. Well, thanks. Well, blessings on your day. Very good being with you all. Thank you.